Cheerscast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Hey, Sam?
Yeah.
Do you think Miss Howe would give me a raise if I asked her?
Well, let's see. You're a good bartender. You've never had a vacation. You've never been out sick. Probably not. You want to go where everybody knows your name.
Hello and welcome back to Cheerscast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. I'm your host, Ryan Daly, and joining us is the co-host of Radio vs. the Martians and Podcast a la Vista, baby. And starting today, he is the new senior associate guest host. Please welcome back our friend, Mike Gillis. What's up, Mike?
Oh, you know, I was going to settle for, you know, just a raise, but if I get to be senior assistant, that is amazing. Because, of course, money gets spent, but titles are forever.
It's one of my favorite lines. That was almost a runner-up for my favorite line of the episode.
Oh, boy. There's so many life lessons in this one.
Yeah. So what episode are we talking about, folks? We are on Season 6, Episode 21. Yeah, we are closing in on the end of the season. The episode is called Our Hourly Bread. This one is written by Sue Herring and directed by Andy Ackerman. Sue Herring, she was an assistant to the Charles brothers for like 9 seasons of the show's runtime. But she did get some writing credits. This was her first of 4 episodes of Cheers. And then she wrote a few episodes of some other shows, but I think was mostly a behind-the-scenes production assistant or producer for other shows. As for Andy Ackerman, he was an editor on Cheers for a long time, and then this is his first directing credit, but he ended up directing 18 episodes out of Cheers total, most of them in seasons 8 and 9, and then after that, what I recognized his name from, he directed a bunch of episodes of Seinfeld, too. So, yeah. Original air date, Thursday, March 10th, 1988. When Sam, Carla, and Woody ask for raises, Rebecca reveals that the bar is losing money and dangerously close to going out of business. Woody comes up with the idea that Cheers raffle off a Caribbean cruise with all of the extra revenue, putting Cheers back in the black. The plan is a success, and Cheers is more popular than ever on the night of the winning drawing. Woody, unfortunately, can't read his own handwriting on the winning ping pong ball and announces the winner is number 99. The crowd cheers for that winner until Sam and Woody correct the mistake, announcing the real number is 66. Both contestants feel they have a claim on the prize. In order to placate the contestants and settle the unruly crowd, Rebecca agrees to buy each of them trips to the Caribbean, even though it'll cost her her career, at which point she breaks down crying. One of the contestants, believing himself every bit the loser Rebecca is, agrees to give up the Caribbean trip. Sam manages to smooth everything over by giving the runner-up a consolation prize, an expensive painting that Frasier had purchased for Lilith but stowed away at the bar. All right, Mike, what did you think about this episode?
Oh, this one's a lot of fun. I mean, Cheers is always great, and I hadn't watched Cheers in actually quite a bit now, and you're just reminded just how good the writing is on this program. I mean, sitcoms, I get the reputation for being the lowest form of television or whatever, but Cheers has always been remarkably smartly written and just has beautifully realized characters, and everything just clicks on this show, and this is just a great example of it.
Yeah, and again, for having a first-time scriptwriter, obviously, I mean, the writer, she was familiar with guys, and the way the show was written so much and so much controlled by the Charles brothers that even a first-time writer would have been, they're subject to like all the rewrites and all the oversight. But yeah, this was a strong and really funny one. And what surprised me about it, like given like where we are in the season, this plot really felt like it. You could have dropped this into one of the earlier seasons of the show. Like, this almost felt kind of like a season 1 or season 2 episode if you just changed the dynamics of, like, Rebecca, obviously, a little bit. But, like, Woody's part in this could have been Coach almost seamlessly. And by now, I think, like, at this point in the show, like, Woody has established himself enough that he is a very different character than Coach. Like, he's not doing the same type of humor every week that Coach did, which is kind of what he was in season 4 when he first showed up. You know, we've given Woody a lot more credit and a lot more room to breathe that way. But the basic premise of the goof and the mistake in this thing, this could have been a coach type of situation. Yeah, I don't know, or this felt like it could have been earlier in the season, but I don't know. I felt like this, something about this kind of gave me like a throwback feel to an earlier time in the history of the show. But it was still very rewarding because Rebecca kind of grounds it at the end by breaking down and showing off her neuroses the way she does so wonderfully in the show.
Oh, absolutely. I really think that one of the things that is such a bonus is that oftentimes when you have a show that has a bunch of established characters and you bring somebody new in and you have to try to find where do they fit in the ecosystem? What is the thing this actor's good at? They've got to find their footing with this character. What are all this people? What are all this character's quirks? How do they react in different situations? And I really think they figured out Rebecca super fast. And one of the things I'm really glad about is they figured out Kirstie Alley's superpower very early on. And that's the sobbing, the racked sobs, where she has this a sort of image that she wants to put out to the world, that she's this put together professional woman who suffers no fools, who sees through lies, who will catch you at any kind of scheme. But there are these situations where all of that just cracks and falls away, and she just turns into a sobbing mess. And you guys have said this on the show before, I don't know how she does this, where her voice just curdles and you can still understand every single word she says, even though her voice is becoming something like embarrassing and hideous. And it's really wonderful.
It's the weirdest thing, and it's like almost to the line of ugly crying, but you never get that sense. It's never that, because she doesn't, you don't break the facade of seeing that, yeah, she's obviously this beautiful put together woman, but like this just like there's something just like broken inside that's just like just gonna flood out and like has to escape. And yeah the way she you put it, and it's the thing that I keep coming back to, the way you think, like, how does she enunciate that? Like, is that just ADR work? Does she just have to re-record all of her dialogue? Because I couldn't imagine somebody being that erudite while still crying that hard.
And still not breaking the illusion, because you kind of have these two things you have to do. You have to have the performance that everyone can understand, but you also have to embody this character. And mm-hmm. this character is the person who was bullied at school, like a 9-year-old girl running up to her room, throwing herself down on the pillow and crying. And it's like that coming out of this adult woman who 10 seconds ago everyone is a little bit intimidated by. And I don't know, but I'm glad they discovered this skill from Kirstie Alley, because she is just spectacular. Yeah. And it's also something that also separates her from Diane, that Diane didn't have this character quirk. And I kind of love the contrast between who this person thinks they are and what they actually are under duress. And there's a lot of other Cheers characters that have this, like Cliff Clavin. He has a very specific idea of what he thinks he's putting out into the world, and it's not who people see him as. Clearly. The same with Frasier. Frasier probably has the most in common with Rebecca in this sense, but Frasier is somebody who seems like he's got it really together, that he can sort of crack anyone else's psyche, that he understands the human mind, and he's this mm-hmm. cultured man of means who just sort of understands the world and has read all of these books. But the second that things start to fall apart, they fall apart really fast for Frasier. And you realize he's like a psychological mess under all of this. And it's a lot of fun. The minute he thinks, my wife is not going to like this present I got her, you get to see him kind of become, like, devolve into a child. And he's so good at those little moments. It's Frasier has those emotional states. It's everywhere between angry Frasier, which is his Sideshow Bob voice, and then there's Frasier freaking out, who turns into like a 13-year-old boy.
Yeah, and just the panic that sets in, and just like, yeah, always so good about that. Yeah,
but I do want to say one thing. Everyone will try to, you know, perceive this episode, and I think even the show perceives this episode as being Woody blundering at the end. But you cannot blame Woody for the mistake during the raffle.
Oh, it was Sam. Yeah,
Sam did it. Because Woody pulls a ball out of the ping pong ball out of the tumbler and reads the number 99. He didn't put a little line underneath the way you do. Like a D&D dice has both a 9 and a 6 on it, and there's a line underneath it to let you know which side it is, because people are going to argue about it. Right. But you know what? It doesn't matter. The minute he says 99, Sam, shut up.
Yes. Yeah.
It's 99. Just go with it. Do not throw a wrench into this. Do not complicate it, because the minute you show doubt, all of Woody. Woody will always follow your lead. He's like a golden retriever.
Yep.
Whatever your emotional state, it's his emotional state. And if you're confused and have doubt, he's going to be even more so. He's like an accelerated version of all of that. And now you've thrown it into hyperdrive. Everybody is angry. And all you had to do, Sam, was just shut up and take the win.
Yep. I caught the same thing when I was doing that. I was like, oh, Sam, he shouldn't have even brought it up. He should have just kept his mouth shut. Or if he didn't, just like make sure, like just tell Woody, like don't say anything. Keep this between us.
Woody with that. Do not trust Woody with that. Because he will say it. Say, it's 99. Yay!
Yeah. Yep. The other thing, though, like, and I was going to save this for later, but we might as well get to it now. Like, so the raffle is apparently the method of this raffle, the drawing is like he got 100 ping pong balls that he individually numbered and put them in there. It's like, does that mean there was only 100 people who entered this competition to the raffle to get like a Caribbean cruise? Like, was that really going to generate enough money like for the bar over a 2 week span that they were like it was going to change everybody's fortune? I was like,
I don't know how this raffle works, because if the goal of this raffle is to get us into the black, that you want to maximize the number of entries.
Yeah.
You have to do it with
and it has
beer.
To offset the price of like a Caribbean cruise. That's
You have to make more of that, and you have to cut out the cost of a Caribbean cruise. So you have to make not only the cost of whatever you were in the red for, but you also have to get the cost of a Caribbean cruise, because if you fail to do that, you've lost even more money. So, I mean, obviously the way to do this is how they should have done it, which is every time you buy a beer, you write your name on the ping pong ball and throw it into the tumbler. So every beer is an entry, so it incentivizes people to buy more beer. And this is, unfortunately, it might be the only way to get Norm to pay for beers. Because you can't count Norm, otherwise Norm would be like half of that tumbler. You have to be just the ones he pays for.
Even when the bar is in dire straits, he's trying to get free beer out of it, which is
I love it. It kind of reminds me of that moment in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. We should let him go. But every time there's any kind of emotional reaction, he decides – he's like, oh, we should celebrate with a free round of beers. We should commiserate with a free round of beers. You should calm down this angry crowd with a free round of beers. I want to say one thing about Norm, and this kind of blew my mind. If there's one thing that just jumped out at me in this episode, is there is a stunt in this one. It's like if I had been on part of the live studio audience when this has happened, I would have been scared.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, am I about to see George Went die? I mean, he takes a fall off a stool when Cliff offers to buy him a beer.
Yeah, and it looks and like he's been like, shot. Like
it looks bad. As a longtime fan of professional wrestling, I can tell you one thing. You do not take a fall on your hip.
Oh, yeah.
And I could say if this was me, if I took the fall that George Went took here, I would probably be walking with a cane right now. It looked bad. It's jarring enough that it made me stop and go, wait, I am watching an edited episode. If I was watching raw footage, I'm like, oh my God, am I watching the footage of the episode they never aired because George Went had a heart attack on set? And it feels like that. You feel really kind of like, okay, it's just a joke. Everyone's reacting to it in character. There isn't this moment where you hear somebody call from off screen. You don't hear the audience gasp or talk amongst themselves. There isn't that uncomfortable silence. But it's the kind of fall that looks like it would happen before that. And I'm like, is George Went okay? I mean, I still want to know, is he okay now? Does he walk with like a limp because of this?
It is the most violent looking fall that is completely unprovoked by anything. Like there's no physical force acting upon him. It is just Cliff saying, let me buy you a beer. That makes it as if he's been struck by lightning, thrown out of his seat.
And
he hits
bad.
The ground. And Sam has to come around. They help him up and everything. And he's like, I thought you were going to buy me a beer. And Cliff's like, I am going to buy you a beer. And he starts to throw himself again, and Sam catches him.
Oh my God. Yeah. I almost chickened out and did a tie for my employee of the week. And it was almost that, just to make sure George Went was okay. But oh my God, it looks like it hurt.
Yeah.
It legitimately looked like it hurt. I would feel bad if Jackie Chan took this fall.
I want to go back right before, because that's how the main episode starts off. But in the teaser, we do get this little moment where Cheers is visited by their mailman, and it's not like they've had a recurring guest mailman, this guy named Walt Twitchell, that has a very antagonistic relationship with Cliff, and it's not this guy, it's another guy. And the whole gag is they walk in and they start talking. They're very friendly, but they have this jargon, this kind of postal stuff that they speak in, like, codes and stuff like that. And Carla and Norm and Rebecca are just looking at him going, what the hell are they talking about? And Norm calls it a postal rap. And he says, I once thought of asking Cliff what it all means, but then it occurred to me he might tell me. It's
You know what that reminded me of? Did you ever play Dungeons and Dragons growing up?
No, not growing up. Not until I was an adult, actually.
Okay, so
I knew of it. I grew up like in the era, so I know what it was. But I'd never actually sat down and played a game until I was in my 20s.
It's been forever since I've played it. I played second edition. That's how long. People who play D&D knows how long ago that was. But when you played a thief in that game, you'd get an extra language slot that was called Thieves' Cant. I don't know if it's still part of the game. But Thieves' Cant is like a slang. It's like certain words that way you can talk in the open to another thief. About illegal doings, or if you like spotted a cop or something, it's just like, oh, I got a little something and I want to try to offload, you know, that sort of stuff. But other people wouldn't understand it. It's not like you can have a full language. This is like the post office version of the thieves' cant.
Nice. But the thing about the punchline of it is Norm's like, yeah, I could have asked him what this, like, to decode all of this language. He's like, but we don't want to hear it. It's like, we don't want Cliff's explanation. And that's the gag. Oh. But when he says it, Rebecca, Kirstie Alley, has this reaction where she kind of, like, smiles. And then, like, it's like a beat later, she actually starts to laugh. And it's this weird thing where it feels like the character Rebecca, her reaction was to smile, and then Kirstie Alley, the actress, thought it was funny, like, a half second later, and kind of started to laugh about it. Like, it was almost like a non-diegetic laugh in the scene.
Yes, yes. I love that. That's the stuff that I love, and I think it's one of the things we've said this before. We're going to repeat ourselves a little bit, but that's the thing that I love with Cheers, is that, not to dog on another show, but I'm about to, but one of the things that people have done as a little creative project on YouTube is they'll take a sitcom that has a laugh track in a live studio audience frequently, and they will cut that laughter out, and you'll see what that performance looks like without it. And what you'll notice when you're kind of distracted by the laughter on a lot of shows is blank stares from characters after one character tells a joke. And it's really uncomfortable when you don't have somebody laughing at it. So in the universe of that show, a lot of times they'll tell a joke, but then this blank, empty space of time that just follows afterwards.
Right.
What I love that Cheers does is people laugh at each other's jokes. They chuckle at each other's jokes. They smile at things they say. So in the universe of Cheers, somebody just told a joke or made a zinger, and they made somebody laugh. And I like that a lot.
Yeah. Everybody seems more authentic that way, because you just believe it. Like, yeah, these people sitting around a bar talking to each other, when they know each other this way, they're going to break each other's balls and they're going to crack each other up. So, yeah, they're a lot of funny. So,
And also, this is the kind of continuation of something I can't imagine that, you know, the writers kind of prepared for, but this friendship between Rebecca and Norm is something I really like. I was trying to figure out what is the basis of this friendship, and I think part of it is that Norm isn't trying to get anything from Rebecca. There is no ulterior motive, and it sort of separates him from, say, Sam, who's always treating everything as an opportunity to flirt or hit on her. But with Norm, there's no ulterior motive, so she can just take everything Norm says at face value and just enjoy the joke. And I think they probably have a bit of a shared experience being corporate drones, that they know what it's like to have a boss who doesn't give a crap about you, barks orders at you, forgets your name. And they have a very different way of responding to that, where Rebecca is, like, desperate to, you know, climb the corporate ladder, and Norm has no ambition whatsoever. But they both kind of they understand that world, and I think there's a kind of camaraderie that the two of them have from that.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't even kind of thought about that part of it, like that Norm would recognize her from a corporate fit, but because that's, well, we don't see him in that world when we're with her, but yeah, that's true, because he did have that background for so long, and he would probably, as much as anybody else, he would kind of see the facade that she puts up, like the fraud of her, because he's probably had to do that when he was at work. Yeah,
exactly. And so, and I think he also sympathizes with her because he kind of gets the situation she's in, where she has bosses that yell at her, and mm-hmm. you know, obviously somebody shows up at Cheers and you're kind of scrambling around to try to make, and Norm gets that.
Right.
He probably has done that countless times.
Right. Right. We do get this running subplot that I kind of just only I skipped over in the summary, but it is Frasier tells them that it is his 1 month anniversary since he's married Lilith, and he's looking for some gift ideas for her. Norm suggests a mink, which is a mock mink, and he says you can't tell the difference really unless it rains, and then you just toss it in the dryer and leave the house for a couple of hours. So the reason that Cliff was going to buy Norm a beer is he mentions that he got his annual postal carrier raise. This sets up this idea that, you know, Woody says he hasn't gotten a raise in 2 years. He's like, I've been expecting one. I haven't gotten diddly. And Cliff tells him, well, go walk up to Rebecca and demand a diddly. And Sam, you know, tells him that Rebecca is tough. She probably won't give him a raise unless she's in a really good mood. And he's like, how do I get her in a good mood? He's like, well, you know, just compliment her, play on it. And as Woody's going to the office, he's like, what should I compliment? He's like, the first thing you see, cut to the visual gag, he walks in, and she's on a stepladder, kind of hunched over to get something on her bookshelf so that her butt is, like, right in his eye line. And, like, could have been, like, bent over the desk or something else, but she's on a ladder, so. He's like, Miss Howe, did I ever tell you you have a really nice eye or smile? He's like, smile or
yeah.
something, yeah.
I really, this is the best kind of Woody joke, because you know how Sam would do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is another example of well-drawn characters. Now imagine every single character in Cheers being asked to respond to this situation with that setup. Woody's my favorite one because Woody wouldn't go there. Woody is just such an innocent. Mm-hmm. And he just, you know, again, I think that's something she likes about Woody, is that Woody also doesn't have ulterior motives. I don't think he could manage to carry an ulterior motive at the same time as another thought.
Right.
He's a simple dude, and you kind of know what you're getting with him. He's not trying to scam anything. Even when he wants something, he's not trying to scam anything.
And that's why it's almost not fair the way she outfoxes him, because as soon as she realizes what he's going to ask, she anticipates it, and she's like, no, wait, what are you? I know what you want, but I can't give you a title. And he's like, what? And he's like, she's like, I know the corporate won't let me do it. He's like, I was going to ask for a raise. She's like, oh yeah, well that's fine. I can give you a raise. I thought you wanted something much more valuable, a title. And he's like, wait, forget about the raise for a second. Let's talk about this. And she's already got him hook, line, and sinker. And that's when he asks his line. He's like, damn it, I should have asked for a title. Money you can just spend, but titles last forever.
There is a way to turn that around, but, you know, Woody's not that kind of guy, which is that, oh, man, I'm going to have to get a decent amount of money to make up for that title. But that's the thing, is just take the money, man. This is the boss's trick. This is the pizza party. This is calling you a hero and an essential worker instead of giving you the raise that you deserve.
Yeah, of course.
And again, like I said, Woody never takes a sick day. Woody doesn't take a day off or vacation. He's the sweetest guy in the world, and it's almost cruel to give him the whole Tom Sawyer paint the fence trick. But I wanted to say one thing. You know what this scene reminded me of? And this is a cliche for me, but I'm about to reference Lord of the Rings. There is a scene in the Two Towers where Gandalf, Theoden, Legolas, Gimli, and the Rohirrim confront Saruman the White up in his tower.
Uh-huh.
And he's trying to use the power of his hypnotic voice to sort of lull them into forgetting that he's utterly defeated and that they've beaten him. But he's trying to use this trick on too many people at once. So people are able to resist the influence. They're able to see through it. And by seeing other people see through it, it snaps them out of it. This is the lesson. Sam, Carla, and Woody needed to confront Rebecca all at once.
Right.
Because separated, her powers can defeat them. But imagine if Carla or Sam had been in the room when she tried this trick on Woody. It wouldn't have worked. And then it would have snapped Woody out of it.
Right.
This is called worker solidarity, and this is how you beat people like this. You go to corporate and you make the argument, because guess what? Together you have a lot more negotiating power. I wonder if there's a word for that. But yeah, it's
I wonder if there's an example perhaps in Hollywood right now that we could point to of
exactly.
something like this.
Because that's the thing. There are not that many people who work at Cheers. There have been at the most four over the course of the series. And guess what? It's not hard to get three of them to sign a card and show up in the office. And Rebecca will probably do the crying thing, but if you can hold firm, you're going to be in a position to negotiate her with that raise, because she's going to try to beg poverty. And here's the thing that I'm going to call BS on in this episode. I don't believe Rebecca when she says the bar is losing money, unless the corporation that Sam sold it to is siphoning so much overhead from this place. There's no way that it's losing money. And I spent way too much time this week thinking about the economics of Cheers and how much money this place brings in. But here's the question. When you see an average episode of Cheers where you've got all the principal characters around the bar, have you ever seen this place really empty unless it's just opening or about to close? It is always packed.
Mm-hmm.
There are always at least 20 extras on there. And if, I mean, obviously inflation has changed the price of a glass of beer, but you know, it's like $5 today and whatever the equivalent in 1988, I think I looked it up. By the way, this is a great website for your tax dollars are paying for it. So you might as well use it. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has an inflation calculator. And it's a great way to find out what the equivalent of how much beer the Blues Brothers drank or how much Winston Zeddemore gets paid. $11.5 a year is really bad, even in today's money. But you can look this sort of stuff up. I think the difference is like a glass of beer. If it's like $5 for a glass of beer now, it's like $2 back in 1988. I looked it up. But if you look at every beer on screen, that's another $2, an equivalent of $5 now. And people drink there a lot. Not only are they that, but the place is always packed. It's right below a restaurant where people are drawn to, people with money, because Melville's looks like a nice, fancy place.
It's got a dress code, yeah.
Exactly. So you have to put on a tie to go up to Melville's. So, yeah, there are people with money that come into Cheers just waiting for their seat.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen Cheers anything less than at least, you know, half capacity. There's always people in there. And, I mean, it's enough that Sam was able, as owner, to afford to drive a Corvette and to be able to buy a house with Diane. So Sam, as owner, was comfortably upper middle class, at least. And still, I mean, he did not run a tight ship when he owned that place. They would frequently stop the bar and go off on a wacky adventure or go bowling, or he'd run up to, like, you know, to a cabin and stuff with a flight attendant or something for a romantic interlude. And he would do that all the time. They would be fine. There was never an episode about how the bar is losing money. So unless it's corporate greed is the problem, and those people are lying to Rebecca, too. Because let's face it, folks, you are underpaid. Too long didn't read Profit is Theft. And it's a sort of thing where I think people don't really understand how much your workplace makes. And that includes Cheers. Mm. When you think about how much you're paid for a day of work and you compare that to how much money came in, you could double Sam, Carl, and Woody's wages, and they'd probably be just fine. Depends on how much, you know, Mr. Drake's, you know, company is taking in. So worker solidarity. These are exactly the sort of people that beg poverty every time the minimum wage is raised and every single time they learn to live with it and the sky doesn't fall. So that's the thing. You just got to stand firm when people try using their hypnotic trick and offering you a title, especially a BS title like Carla. Carla was the managing director of waitresses. She is the only waitress. She has at least Woody can lord his title over Sam.
Oh, Sam becomes the executive supervising bartender.
Yeah, so I mean, you can at least compare it to somebody else. There's nobody for Carla is literally the managing director of herself, and you cannot buy this. Do not take a pizza party from your boss. You deserve a wage. You deserve a fair wage because this bar is doing fine.
Well, Norm thinks that each one of these promotions is worthy of a free round of drinks.
Oh, yeah. See, Norm has his finger on the ball. He knows exactly what his priorities are, and he advocates for his own interests.
Yeah. So once they have all... once they've all confronted her individually, Rebecca comes out and she does tell them truthfully or not, whether it's legitimate or not, she's like, the bar is losing money for months, and if business doesn't turn around, she'll be fired and the bar will close. Norm says, Cheers means about as much to me as anyone, and I think sad news like this deserves a sympathy round of free drinks. And, like, the look that Sam gives him, like, dude, bad timing, read the room type of thing. Like,
a squeaky wheel, man. You gotta ask for what you want.
Yeah. And Cliff's
especially when everyone is mad at the end. That was the best chance he had to get that free round of beer.
I know. And Cliff is like, what are we gonna do if the bar closes? Where are we gonna go? And Norm is like, home? He's like, just that idea of threat, like, that almost knocked him off his seat again. So they do come up with this, Norm has another idea, because they're looking for ideas to drum up business, and Carla's like, what do? Force people to drink? Just pour beers down their throats? And Sam goes, no, obviously not. And Norm's like, well, don't be hasty, let her talk.
Squeaky wheel, Norm. Keep pushing, man.
And then, of course, he's like, Norm is like, well, you know, in big companies, whenever they need to save money, the first thing they do is fire all the dead wood, like Norm. And he's like, what did you do after that? He's like, I'm long gone. I have no idea. But Woody comes up with the idea for this raffle, and they talk about a Caribbean cruise, and they pitch it to Rebecca, and she's like, fine, whatever. The subplot, again, going back, that Frasier is looking for this gift. He buys this painting for Lilith for their anniversary. And Cliff is like, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's one of the Machiavellian Cubist era, isn't it? And Frasier's like, no, Cliff, but thank you for participating. Norm goes, would it be rude to ask how much something like that costs? And Frasier's like, well, not if you like it and appreciate it. And Norm is just like, I'm sorry to interrupt. never mind. And the whole thing about this one is Frasier says it's an original Tidwell, and it represents man's struggle against intransigent fate, and it's called Number 7. So, the total pompous thing, because Norm is like, it looks like two dogs about to get it on, or something like that, or Woody says that. So, Frasier asks...
But that's the thing, is I think the audience, we're kind of conditioned to assume that Woody's assumption is wrong, that there's some kind of higher purpose. But then other people, the gang starts to back them up, and you start to get a little bit of doubt. But then later, with that painting, Rebecca sees it, and her description to Frasier, she's been keeping it in the office.
Yeah,
she thinks it's about two dogs,
get that painting of the two dogs out of my office?
And then at the end with Lilith, where Lilith describes it as an overpriced painting of two dogs commingling. And so I'm led to believe this really is just a painting of two dogs having sex.
And Frasier just does not get it, of course, because, he asks Rebecca if he can store it in her office for a few days, and she looks at the painting and she's like, I hope Lilith loves you very much,
Oh, my God. Yeah, I love... So, at the end, did Frasier... Did he just abandon this painting, or is he going to want it back later?
That's the funny thing, because when he asks Lilith, he's like, have you heard of Tidwell? And she's like, oh, he's that, the guy who sold his painting to some ninny for a boatload or something. And he's like, yeah. He's like, anyway, for the anniversary, I got you my car. He, like, panics and gives her the keys to his Mercedes. He's like, nothing says love like something from Stuttgart. And he's like...
Oh, my God.
And then she's like, why did you ask about Tidwell? And he makes up an excuse that that's his name for the car, but at that point it's like, I think he wants to put as much distance between the painting as he can. Like, he's just too embarrassed by it.
So Frasier's like the big loser in this episode. Frasier has he overpaid for a painting, and he lost his car, which means he has to buy a new one. So I mean, and all of it, it's just like he has a whole sitcom plot happening in the background of this one.
Yeah.
And it's only a matter of time before he's like, oh, man, I better sell that painting to pay for my new car.
They almost need one more scene with him at the end, like to where he realizes that the painting's gone, too. Like, he can't even get his money back.
I just want to say again, and I know this has been said 1,000 times, and it'll be said 1,000 more, but B.B. Newworth as Lilith is one of my favorite characters on this show, and she does deadpan better than anybody.
And I wish I would have given you an episode with her when she has more dialogue, because she's only in the one short scene, but she does have this thing where he's like, close your eyes, and she's like, oh, Frasier, I don't like that. My father once asked me to close my eyes, and he left for 2 years.
Oh, my God. This is the thing that I love, is I love an actor who can just nail a line that you can tell that it's good on paper, but they make it so much better in delivery. This is why I love J.K. Simmons and oh God, what's her name? The mom from Archer and also in Arrested Development, Jessica Walter.
Jessica Walter, yeah.
Jessica Walter is another one of those actors that just nails a line. Bebe Neuwirth is in on the Mount Rushmore of making dialogue sound great.
Yeah. Just before we get to the end, just before we wrap this, there's one moment when we first come back and it's like 2 weeks later and the bar is crowded, everybody's ready, they're all wearing like Calypso gear or Hawaiian shirts or something like
that.
They
got a band.
They do have, they have a band with steel drums and everything like that. They're playing the island music for in anticipation of this cruise. Like, this is a whole big thing. And Norm and Cliff aren't happy with how crowded the place is. And Norm says he liked the way Cheers used to be before all these people started using it as a public gathering. And I'm like, is Norm the original hipster? Like, he liked Cheers before it was cool.
Oh my God, yeah. Norm just kind of comes with the building. I love Norm. I think that if you look at a lot of other characters that have various quirks, or, you know, they've got, like, Cliff Clavin has a complete delusion about himself and his place in the world, who talks about the Postal Service like he's in the Jedi Order or the Green Berets or something. And I truly believe if you wanted to make Cliff Clavin cry, I mean, really break him, you would fire him and, like, dramatically rip a patch off his uniform, and that would break him. The way he feels about the post office. This is a man who has delusions, but Norm is just funny,
and he is kind of like, he's the perfect everyman in that he's never going to be the romantic hero. He's not the lead. He doesn't have the physique or the charisma or the looks for that. He's not crazy, and he's not stupid.
And he has the most realistic idea of who he is.
Yeah.
And what his place in the world is.
He's incredibly content. So he kind of is the vehicle for the audience inside the show, because he's happy to sit and watch. And that's what we're doing as an audience, as spectators. He is us in the show. He's there sitting and watching us and occasionally making fun of these goofballs as they're having these crazy adventures around him.
Yeah, there's a self-awareness to what he does. I mean, if you look at, like, a lot of other characters, you can say they think of themselves as the main character of their own story. Like, clearly, like, Rebecca and Sam, and definitely Cliff thinks he's the main character of Cheers. But Norm doesn't think that. Norm knows his place, finds happiness and contentment in it, and finds his joy where he can get it. And even if he's not going to get a free beer, he still wants to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gets something out of getting a smile or a chuckle out of one of his friends. Yeah. And that's his joy. And honestly, living in a pandemic for the last few years, those little bits of human interaction are the one real currency that human beings have, you know, our relationships with other people. And I think Norm has a better understanding of the world in a very real sense than a lot of other people who tend to be either kind of stuffy like Frasier and have you know, pompous idea of who they are in their place in the world, or even Diane, but Norm gets it. He kind of understands the world, his place in it, and he has probably the least illusions of anyone on Cheers.
Once the two winning numbers are called, and the two winners start kind of arguing over who has a better claim to the winner, and the bar, like, the energy turns kind of hostile and angry, like, what's going on? Is this a scheme? Like, why can't you guys get your stuff together? So Sam's first tactic is trying to tell them that, hey, you don't even want this prize. He's like, you guys don't want to go to the Caribbean or the Bahamas right now. He's like, you know what the sun will do to your skin? And they're like, what are you talking about? And he's like, what am I talking about? He looks around, and he grabs Al. Bless his heart, he grabs Al, and he's like, this is last year's winner. He's only 24 years old.
And Al, I love it.
And Al just goes, I fell asleep on the beach.
I love it. Al just goes with it. Al is a trooper, man. He's game to help out. He has no skin in the game, but he gets what Sam's doing. So, you know, it really wouldn't have been that bad of an idea to give out a free round of beers. Let's be honest. Beer at a bar is like 75% markup. It's like candy at the movie theater. This is, again, part of these costs. Why I don't believe this bar is losing money is that you can go out to a grocery store and buy a 12-pack of pretty much the same beer for today's equivalent of $16 instead of $5 a glass, they can afford to hand that out to stop people from burning this place down.
Al Swearingen knew how to handle a crowd like this in the first episode of Deadwood, I'll just say.
Yeah, yeah, that's how you run a bar, with a lot of profanity and threats of violence.
Half-price prostitutes for the next half hour. So.
Yeah. You gotta give some discounts. Yeah. So here's my question for you. At the end, when Rebecca starts sobbing, and she's so good at it, did she play us? Did she trick us into thinking she had lost it? Because Sam says, "Well, why don't you give the crowd some tears to get some sympathy to get out of this?" She rejects it, but she immediately goes into tears. Is she really breaking down, trying not to do what Sam did? Or is she like a genius? Is this like, this is like some deeper, like, you know, Hannibal Lecter acting manipulation?
I don't think the character is that good. I think she is so like just holding on by a thread that the glint of what her future might portend was enough to just break her, and that first little tear, like, just,
and then the customer starts crying, and then they hold each other crying,
and she's like there when she says that. Yeah, because he the number 66 is a loser. He's like, he never won anything, he can't hold on a job, his wife left, his kids won't talk to him, and they start consoling each other, and 99 is like, well, you know, you can. He's like, you can have the trip because my wife will understand. He's like, I married this wonderful woman who's always has a positive attitude, and to think she can keep up like that despite being confined to a wheelchair.
Oh my god!
And everyone starts feeling bad, and then this perfect moment, Carla comes out. She's like, wait, what about my sob story? I have 8 kids, and she starts to sort of like fake cry and dead silence. And it's punctuated by, of all people, Cliff says, "Heard it." And the way he says that line, it is like, F you, Carla. It's like, no. It's like,
he's
no
going to pay for that later. No, man. Yeah, he's like, enjoy exactly, this exactly. You got
she'll,
it, Cliff.
She'll get him. But he's like, no sympathy for it. It is such a harsh condemnation. Oh. It's like, yeah, Carla, your life sucks. We're familiar with that. That's old news. It is so cruel. It's like,
she could have easily gone past I Have 8 Kids. She could have told some stories of just the stuff we've seen happen on Cheers. Yeah. Carla, at the heart, the thing that hurts Carla is so used to these kind of hardships that it's hard for her to be. She's got like a callus. She really has the force field that Rebecca pretends to have. Carla is a survivor, so it's hard for her to get those sorts of tears because she really is tough in a way a lot of other people aren't. But man, Norm is going to go outside. All the air is going to be out of his tires. I swear, it's going to be bad.
And that's when Sam comes over. They can't both be winners, but Sam says, well, one of them can get the special bonus surprise, and he has this painting, and it's in, like, the number 66 guy is like, is that an original Tidwell? He's like, I've always dreamed of owning an original Tidwell. And Carla goes, oh, and you tried to tell us you were a loser. So everyone is satisfied and happy, and then Woody gets their attention for another drawing. He's like, the winner gets all of the extra ping pong balls. And he holds up, he's like, and the winner is number 11. And then he turns it upside down. He's like, oh no. And it's supposed to be this gag that it's a different number. But I was like, I think they missed the joke. I think it should have been either 9 or 6 or something like that.
No, but I mean, the joke is obviously that he's freaking out, but 11 upside down is just 11.
It's still 11. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That it's like, no, it's fine. Okay. It's fine. I kind of love the 11 joke for that one reason, is that he doesn't see it. The fact is, he turns it upside down and you see his face go white, and it's just like, but it's the same number. And it's the fact that he still panics and realizes that it's still a number. I love that joke.
All right, let's get to the superlatives. For Norm's tab, despite all of his demanding of free beers, he had 5 in this episode. And really, once we get to the point, I was really looking closely, because once we get to the night of the drawing, it starts off when he's got an empty beer mug in front of him. So I gave him credit for that for 1. And it doesn't get refilled ever. There's like one shot or something where it looks like the beer next to him is full or half full. But I think that might have been a continuity or editing mistake, because there's no explanation for when it would ever get filled, and he never like goes for the glass or anything like that. So I think that was a mistake. So I gave him 5 beers for this episode, which brings him up to 570 for the series up to this point.
So predictions, now that we're past the halfway point, do you think Norm is going to break 1,000 by the end of the series?
Yes, primarily because of one episode down the road where I think he might have like 200 in that episode.
Oh, okay.
Who is your employee of the week?
Like I said, I came really close to giving this to Norm because of that fall that he took, because that looked painful bad. That looked like this isn't supposed to happen bad. But I'm giving this to Rebecca. Rebecca's breakdown and the fact that she got actual tears. You could see actual tears in Kirstie Alley's eyes. And it was the boy at school doesn't like me. And it was so, she does it so convincingly. And I think this is maybe her best maybe her second best tirade yet. Because the best line she's had in a tirade was the last one you had in a recent episode with, and he doesn't want to be my boyfriend. Yeah. That's probably the best, but this one was so good. And actual tears. Kirstie Alley was such a find for this show.
Absolutely. I did give it to Norm. Norm was my employee of the week just because, like, just the quality. Like, every line he had was gold, and he had a lot, and, like, a whole string of them. My runner-up was Woody, though, because Woody actually had my home run, my favorite part of the episode, which we didn't talk about, but it's when he first gets their attention for the first drawing. And he starts, he's like, this is the most excited I've been since our prize cow Velveeta gave birth to a two-headed calf. And everybody's like, what? He's like, I don't know if you've ever seen a two-headed calf born, but those who have will bear me out. And Sam was like, Woody, don't talk about this. Like, get to something. And Woody just keeps on going. He's like, actually, it's not as exciting as you might think, because only one of the heads can move. And Sam is just trying to get him to stop. And you see the others just looking at him like, what the hell, kid?
I kind of want to hear the rest of this story.
It's so
this
precious.
Is pretty good stuff. That's pretty great. That's the thing with Woody, is that you never doubt Woody Harrelson as Woody Boyd for a second. I think he so embodies this character. And then his character is such a heightened reality sort of innocent guy that it would be so easy for him to break a show. I mean, the same thing with Coach, too, is that they were so lucky to not only find somebody who can act with such utter sincerity. God, Woody's good.
Yeah. What was your best moment or your home run?
I'm going to say it's the first line where Woody asks, he says, like, Sam, do you think Miss Howe would give me a raise if I asked her? And Sam's like, well, let's see. You're a good bartender. You've never had a vacation. You've never been out sick. Probably not. That's probably my best line. So that I absolutely love that. But I think the 11 one and the look on Woody's face is right up there. Just a look of terror. Like, oh no, it's happening again. But I'm going to say, probably not. Just the way that Ted Danson says that line is just great.
Yeah, that's perfect. Perfect. Oh, Mike, thank you for coming back to Cheerscast and going over this episode with us. Where else can people find you if they want to hear more from you in the podcastosphere?
So I and Casey Doran, my tag team partner in podcasting, co-host a couple shows. The first one is Radio Versus the Martian, sort of a pop culture book club where we talk about various pop culture topics, movies, comic books, everything in between, horror, And the other one is Podcast La Vista Baby, which is a movie-by-movie master's course about the cinematic oeuvre of statesman and bodybuilder Arnold Schwarzenegger. We're almost wrapped up on that. I think we only have about 5 or 6 episodes left.
Wow.
Of movies we have yet to cover. We're saving one of our absolute favorites for last, so stay tuned on that. You can find those shows on RadioVersusTheMartians.com. PodcastLaVistaBaby.com. We're kind of off of most social media nowadays. We're definitely off Twitter.
yeah, me too.
We're just kind of eating popcorn and watching the sinking ship. But we do have a Discord, and that's probably the main place you'd want to see us online. If you're a big fan of Elon Musk, you will not have a good time on that Discord server. But otherwise, it's a lot of fun.
Back to the Arnold of it all. I assume you have, but have you seen the 3-part Netflix documentary about him? And any chance you would cover something like that on the show?
Absolutely. I think the plan right now is that is going to be the second to last episode. In the very first episode, we talked about what our favorite kind of the Arnold moment is, which is, of course, you know, Commando, which is like the ultimate Arnold movie. And we want to kind of go back to the beginning as sort of a summation and do Arnold, the miniseries from Netflix, as the second to last episode.
That's cool. That's cool. Yeah, I watched that recently, and I was fascinated by that. I was, wow, this is really a lot of stuff that I knew, but a lot of stuff I didn't. Like, there was a lot of brand new information in that I thought was just really fascinating, really cool.
Dude has a crazy life, and if there's an interesting fun fact that you want to know about Arnold Schwarzenegger, it's that he tricked Sylvester Stallone into doing the movie Stop or My Mom Will Shoot by pretending that he was interested in doing it, and the two of them had this, you know, cinematic rivalry at the time. But Arnold is a bit of a prankster. You kind of learn when you watch something. He tricks people by giving them advice or pretending that he wants something. He gets people to take something that nobody should take. And, you know, feign some interest in a movie that he knew would be bad, and then, you know, hanging back and giggling after Sylvester Stallone does it.
No, because you think of him first and sometimes only exclusively as this physical specimen, and you don't realize that he's like a master of psychological warfare. Like, what a mind in that guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Go watch the movie Pumping Iron.
Yeah, that's true.
If you want to see
what he does to
the Terminator bully the Incredible Hulk, that is the movie to see. And if you want to feel bad for a human being and want to give him a hug, it'll definitely Lou Ferrigno in that movie. That dude has it way too hard. I just want Lou to be okay.
All right. Well, again, Mike, thank you very much for being a guest on the show. Can't wait to talk to you again. And those of you out here listening, thanks to all of you again who support the show by liking and sharing on social media and leaving comments on the website fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also support the Fire and Water Podcast Network on Patreon. This show is patronized by the Right On Network and Jeff and Rick Presents Unpacking the Power of Power Pack. Go to patreon.com/FW Podcast to support your favorite show on the Fire and Water Network. Thanks everyone for listening, and until next time, we're closed.
Now's the moment we've all been waiting for. I hope you're as excited as I am, because this is probably the most exciting event I've ever been to in my entire life. Well, except for the time that our prize cow Velveeta gave birth to a two-headed calf. Now, I don't know how many of you have seen a two-headed calf get born, but the ones who have will bear me out.
Woody.
Actually, it's not as exciting as you might think. Only one of the heads could move.
Woody.
The other one just seemed kind of dazed.
Hey, Woody, pick the damn number, will you?
Okay.